The lands Columbus reached, the connected continents of North and South America, had been discovered by Europeans at least once before, in the year 1001. Viking adventurers from Greenland had sailed west and established several short-lived outposts, at least one of them in the Canadian region now called Newfoundland. But by the time Columbus set sail from Spain in 1492, the memory of those voyages had long since faded. Some historians contend that during the 15th century, a few northern European fishermen probably found the rich fishing grounds known as the Newfoundland Banks, just off the northeastern coast of North America. But if they did, they kept the location a secret in order to preserve their exclusive access to the bounty of the North Atlantic. This is why Columbus's voyage was so extraordinarily important. It changed the boundaries of the world as it had previously been known to Europeans, Asians, and Africans, from their perspective adding an entirely new dimension to human existence. And from the perspective of the residents of the Americas, it did the same, bringing to their shores alien peoples from previously unknown lands. And not just peoples. The Europeans came with their animals, their plants, and, ominously, their diseases. On his second voyage in 1493, Columbus brought to Hispaniola 17 ships loaded with 1,200 men, seeds, plants, livestock, chicken, and dogs, along with microbes, rats, and weeds. The settlement named Isabella, which has recently been located in the modern Dominican Republic, and other outposts, became the staging area for the Spanish invasion of America. On the islands of Cuba and Hispaniola, the Europeans learned to adapt to the new environment, as did the horses, cattle, and hogs they imported. When the Spaniards moved onto the mainland, they rode island-bred horses and ate island-bred cattle and hogs. Spanish explorers first fanned out around the Caribbean basin. Juan Ponce de León reached Florida, and Vasco Núñez de Balboa crossed the Isthmus of Panama to the Pacific Ocean. Later, conquistadors traveled farther. Francisco Vázquez de Coronado journeyed through the southwestern portion of what is now the United States, and Hernán de Soto explored the southeast. Francisco Pizarro, who ventured into western South America, acquired the richest silver mines in the world by conquering and enslaving the Incas. But the most important conquistador was Hernán Cortés, who in 1521 seized control of the Aztec Empire. For many years, historians argued that Cortés's few troops conquered the mighty Aztecs because of European horses and guns, which, it was said, had amazed and overwhelmed the Indians. Now it has become clear, though, that the most powerful weapon in Cortés's arsenal was something else entirely. Smallpox. Cortes's initial attempt to conquer Tenochtitlan failed, and he and his men withdrew to regroup. But they left behind the virus that ensured their victory. Spaniards who joined Cortes's men in the spring of 1520 carried to the mainland a smallpox epidemic that began on Hispaniola in late 1518. There ensued what is known as a virgin soil epidemic, as people who had never been exposed to the virulence of smallpox died by the scores. The pandemic fatally weakened Tenochtitlan's defenders. It spread over the people as great destruction, an elderly Aztec survivor told a Spanish priest many years later. Some it quite covered with pustules on all parts, their faces, their heads, their breasts. There was great havoc. Tenochtitlan surrendered, and the Spaniards built Mexico City on its site. Cortés and his men seized a fabulous treasure of gold and silver. Smallpox was not the only major participant in what the historian Alfred Crosby has called the Columbian Exchange. A broad mutual transfer of diseases, plants, and animals among the continents resulted directly from the European voyages of the 15th and 16th centuries. The two hemispheres had evolved separately for thousands of years, developing widely different forms of life. Many large mammals, like cattle and horses, were native to the connected continents of Europe, Asia, and Africa. But the Americas contained no domesticated beasts larger than dogs and llamas. The vegetable crops of the Americas, particularly corn, beans, squash, cassava, and potatoes, were not only more nutritious, but also produced higher yields than those of Europe and Africa, such as wheat, millet, and rye. In time, Native Americans learned to raise and consume European livestock, and Europeans and Africans became accustomed to planting and eating American crops. The diets of all three peoples were consequently vastly enriched. Partly as a result, the world's population doubled over the next 300 years. Yet at the same time, many diseases carried from Europe and Africa, not just smallpox, had a devastating impact on the Americas. Indians fell victim to microbes that had long infested the other continents and had repeatedly killed hundreds of thousands, but had also left survivors with some measure of immunity. The statistics are staggering. When Columbus landed on Hispaniola in 1492, approximately 500,000 people resided there. 50 years later, fewer than 2,000 native inhabitants were still alive. Within 30 years of the first landfall at Guanahani, not one Taino survived in the Bahamas. Overall, historians estimate that the arrival of alien microorganisms could have reduced the pre-contact American population by as much as 90%, especially because the epidemics continued to recur at 20 to 30 year intervals. But the Americans took a revenge of sorts. They gave the Europeans syphilis, a virulent venereal disease. The first recorded European case of the new ailment occurred in Barcelona, Spain, in 1493, shortly after Columbus's return from the Caribbean. Although less likely than smallpox to cause immediate death, syphilis was dangerous and debilitating. Carried by soldiers, sailors, and prostitutes, it spread quickly through Europe and Asia, reaching as far as China by 1505. Two items were especially important parts of the Columbian exchange. Horses, which were brought to America by Columbus in 1493, fell into the hands of North American natives during the 17th century. Through trade and theft, horses spread among the peoples of the Great Plains, reaching most areas by 1750. Lakotas, Comanches, and Crows, among others, came to use horses for transportation and hunting, calculated their wealth in the number of horses owned, and waged wars primarily from horseback. Because of the acquisition of horses, Indian nations that had combined hunting and gathering with agriculture came to focus almost wholly on hunting buffalo. And so, ironically, what is today probably the most common image of the traditional American Indian life, the Plains Indian on horseback, derived from European contact. In America, Europeans encountered tobacco, which at first they believed to have beneficial medicinal effects. Smoking and chewing the Indian weed became a fad in Europe after it was planted in Turkey in the 16th century. Despite the efforts of such skeptics as King James I of England, who in 1604 pronounced smoking loathsome to the eye, hateful to the nose, harmful to the brain, and dangerous to the lungs, tobacco's popularity climbed. Throughout the colonial period, the prosperity of the Chesapeake region depended on the sale of tobacco. I have not yet discussed the involvement of the English in the Columbian encounter, and I will close by doing so. After Cortez conquered the Aztecs, English merchants and political leaders watched enviously as Spain's American possessions enriched Spain immeasurably. In the mid-16th century, English sea dogs like John Hawkins and Sir Francis Drake began to raid Spanish treasure ships sailing home from the West Indies. Their actions caused friction between the two countries and helped to foment a war that in 1588 culminated in the defeat of a huge invasion force, the Spanish Armada, off the English coast. As a part of the contest with Spain, English leaders started to think about planting colonies in the Western Hemisphere, thereby gaining better access to valuable trade goods and simultaneously preventing their enemy from dominating the Americas. The first English colonial planners took Spain's possessions as both a model and a challenge. They hoped to reproduce Spanish successes by dispatching to America men who would similarly exploit the native peoples for their own and their nation's benefit. In the mid-1570s, a group that included Sir Humphrey Gilbert and his younger half-brother, Sir Walter Raleigh, began to promote a scheme to establish outposts that could trade with the Indians and provide bases for attacks on New Spain. Approving the idea, Queen Elizabeth I authorized first Gilbert, then Raleigh, to colonize North America. Gilbert failed to plant a colony in Newfoundland, dying in the attempt, and Raleigh was only briefly more successful. After two preliminary expeditions, in 1587, he sent 117 colonists to the territory he named Virginia, after Elizabeth, the Virgin Queen. They established a settlement on Roanoke Island in what is now North Carolina. But in 1590, a resupply ship, delayed in leaving England because of the Spanish Armada, could not find them. The colonists had vanished, leaving only the word Croatan, the name of a nearby island, carved on a tree. Recent tree ring studies have shown that the North Carolina coast experienced a severe drought between 1587 and 1589, which would have created a subsistence crisis for the settlers and which could well have led them to abandon the Roanoke site. The best source on the Roanoke colony is Thomas Harriot's A Brief and True Report of the Newfound Land of Virginia, published in 1588. The pictures you are now seeing illustrated Harriot's book. They were drawn by John White, an artist who was the governor of the 1587 colony. Harriot, a noted scientist who sailed with the second of the preliminary voyages to Roanoke, described the animals, plants, and people of the region for an English readership. His account revealed that although explorers depended on nearby villagers for most of their food, they needlessly antagonized their neighbors by killing them for what Harriot himself admitted were unjustifiable reasons. The scientist advised later colonizers to deal with the native peoples of America more humanely than his comrades had. But the content of his book suggested why that advice would be rarely followed. A Brief and True Report examined the possibilities for economic development in America. Harriot stressed 3 points: the availability of commodities familiar to Europeans, like grapes, iron, copper, and fur-bearing animals; the potential profitability of exotic American products, such as maize, cassava, and tobacco; and the relative ease of manipulating the native population to the Europeans' advantage. Should the Americans attempt to resist the English by force, Harriot asserted, the latter's advantages of disciplined soldiers and superior weaponry would quickly deliver victory. Harriot's Brief and True Report depicted for his English readers a bountiful land full of opportunities for quick profit. The people already residing there would, he thought, easily come under English rule through conversion to Christianity, admiration for European superiority, or conquest, if they did not die from disease, the ravages of which he witnessed. Thomas Harriot understood the key elements of the story, but his prediction was far off the mark. European dominance of North America would be difficult to achieve. Indeed, some historians today argue that it never was fully achieved in the sense Harriot and his compatriots intended, and that the societies that subsequently developed in North America owed as much to their native origins as to their immigrant ones. For further information about Raleigh's Roanoke and about other early European colonization efforts in what is now the United States, you can visit the websites listed here.